thanks for the special music, because it certainly adds another lesson that we can enjoy here at services. The title of my sermon today is Be Not Soon Shaken. Be Not Soon Shaken. To explain why I chose this title, we'll go to a scripture in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, and we'll look at verses 1 and 2. So this is where I've taken my title from. And in 2 Thessalonians 2, it says, "Now, brethren, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus and our gathering together to him, we ask you not to be soon shaken in mind or troubled either by spirit or by word or by letter, as if from us, as though the day of Christ had come." So there was a heresy that was being circulated in the church in Thessalonica, and the people, this was unsettling the church. Some people were having some questions and some doubts. We've talked at the time of trumpets about 1 Thessalonians, where Paul is answering questions there that people in the church at Thessalonica had. So this just compounds the problem. So there were questions, but when people begin to circulate false teachings, it can undermine. And that was the challenge that they were facing there. So we don't exactly know what they were doing to cause this problem in the church, but some people were being impacted by this erroneous teaching, and it was provoking distress and some confusion, and that's what happens when you get false teachings that begin to impact the church. So Paul is exhorting the church, look, we taught you the truth. When we came into the church there in Thessalonica, we taught you the truth. So you know what the truth is. You know the answer to this question. I've already answered some of your questions in an earlier letter, so hold fast to that. Don't let anybody undermine your faith. So what Paul says here is a caution for us living here in the 21st century. It seems like a long way back, and these things aren't impacting us, but sadly, we live in a world where there's plenty of confusion, plenty of false ideas that are circulating around, and things haven't changed on that front. So we need to be aware of what the truth is, and that gives us stability because we can always look to that. Okay, what is the truth? We hear this, and you know, it's an act of faith to understand the truth and stick to it, live by it. And not only was there a problem about a falsehood that was taking place here in Thessalonica, but as you go back to the time of Isaiah was discussing this very issue. In Isaiah chapter 8, verse 19, he's talking to the people of Judah and telling them, look, you need to hold to the truth. And he says, beginning in verse 19, "And when they say to you, seek those who are mediums and wizards." So if anybody tells you that, you just stay away. You do not listen to that or get involved with that at all. And it says, "who whisper and mutter." I don't think we want to listen to that, but this was something that was happening in Isaiah's time. They were saying, should not people seek their God? Well, that's not how you seek your God. Should they seek the dead on behalf of the living? We don't have seances and that kind of thing. All of that is a pathway into the darkness. So where do we look? Isaiah helps to lay it out for us beautifully there. It says, to the law and to the testimony, if they do not speak according to this word, it is because there is no light in them. So the word of God is immovable, never changes. It's been written. We've had it completed for close to 2,000 years. It's been reliable ever since it was written in Old Testament times, and it still is reliable, something that we can measure the things that we hear and that people offer to us, and we can say, okay, what are they saying here? And we can make a judgment based on that. So if they do not speak according to this word, it is because there is no light in them. So if it deviates from God's word, you got to say, I don't think this is what I want to listen to or pay attention to or allow myself to be motivated by. So there was a certain amount of confusion that had circulated in the church. And as I said, Paul talked about this in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. And despite previous clarifications, there was still some confusion in the church. So as Paul is talking about this and the coming of Christ and the resurrection of the dead, that's basically what he's talking about. You might ask, was this, you know, we have had to think about this in our time. Is Christ going to come at any moment? Have you ever thought that? Christ could come any time. We don't know when he's going to come. Well, no, that's not what the Bible tells us. In fact, and it says that Christ is going to come. And in one sense, the coming of the Lord began when Christ rose to heaven and returned to his Father. Because at that time, you could say that, and the Greek indicates this, the day of the Lord is in the process of coming. And that process began when Christ is returned to heaven. But what does Christ say, or what did Christ inspire to be said to the angels as they're standing there? They're all looking up in the sky at Christ ascending on the Mount of Olives, and then there are these two angels, and they're like, hey guys, why are you looking up in the sky? Because they knew this was concerning to them. And this is in Acts chapter 1, verse 9. It says, now when he had spoken these things while they watched, he was taken up. And so Christ is speaking to his disciples, and then he began to rise into the sky, and a cloud received him out of sight. So he disappeared up into the clouds. We're all familiar with that. And while they looked steadfastly toward heaven, as he went up, behold, two men stood by them in white apparel, who said also, men of Galilee, why do you stand gazing up into heaven? This same Jesus who was taken up from you into heaven will so come in like manner as you saw him go into heaven. So he ascended into the clouds and is now with his Father in the third heaven. And the angels relayed to them, look, you've seen him ascend. Well, there is coming a day when he will descend. And so if you happen to be alive at that point, you're going to be able to look up into the sky and see Jesus Christ in the process of returning. And where is he going to return to? To the Mount of Olives. So he's given a specific location he's going to return to. And it should be quite a sight, since the saints will rise to meet him in the air and will accompany him to the Mount of Olives. So it's going to be a spectacular event. So it's not happened in my lifetime. It's been a promise since the time that this incident occurred. Consider if somebody that was supposedly a leader in the church or professed to be a leader in the church sent you a letter or a message of some way that said Christ has come. The day of Christ has come. So would you be unsettled, unsure, uncertain? You shouldn't be. That's what Paul is telling them, and he's telling us the same thing. This false teaching, there was a false teaching about the day of Christ having already come that was circulating in the church here. So this was a challenge to the people there. The issue was the coming of the Lord and our being gathered to him. We know that that is what trumpets is all about. We've reviewed that many times, and it is essential to our salvation. And it's interesting to note that it's not only in Thessalonica that this was a problem. This was something that was impacting the church in Thessalonica, but it was also impacting the church in Ephesus and the church in Corinth. And we have evidence of that. And so let's look at 2 Timothy chapter 2 that points this out. 2 Timothy chapter 2. There it says, "But shun profane and idle babblings, for they will increase more to more ungodliness." So don't take heed what is being said. If people offer you things you know are not biblical, don't listen to them. Don't listen to them, because as you move away from the scriptures and you begin to entertain these extraneous ideas that are not biblical, what does it do? It leads to more ungodliness, because you no longer have a foundation, and you begin to move away from the sure foundation and the stability that comes from it. Verse 17, "And their message will spread like cancer." It'll spread like cancer. And when these things begin to circulate and take hold, they can spread quickly. "Hymenaeus and Philetus are of this sort." So they were spreading these false teachings that were impacting the church in Ephesus. "Who have strayed concerning the truth, saying that the resurrection is already past." It's already over. The resurrection has already taken place. And if you were a Christian, that's going to be unsettling. Well, wait a minute. We were promised that we were going to be a part of that. So did we miss the cut? This has already taken place and no longer applies? "And they overthrow the faith of some." So people throughout the history of the Church of God have been impacted in this way. And, as you recognize something as false and you reject it, then it gives you, you're adhering to the Word of God, and it gives you stability. This was also a false teaching in Corinth. And Paul addresses this in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, and we'll just look at verses 12 and 13. 1 Corinthians 15, verses 12 and 13. It says, "If Christ is preached that he has been raised from the dead, how do some among you say there is no resurrection of the dead?" So people are questioning whether Christ rose from the dead. And if you're questioning this, whether Christ was resurrected, that's a very serious challenge for those of the people of God who are in the faith. And as he says, "But if there is no resurrection of the dead, then Christ is not risen." And then what do we have? You have nothing to cling to. That hope is gone. So if that's the case, then we have hope in this life only. And that's not much to hold on to. When you see an issue being used to attack various congregations, so you have Thessalonica being impacted, you have Ephesus being impacted, you have Corinth being impacted that we know of. There may have been others in this time. And it's interesting that this is a multi-pronged approach, and that's exactly how Satan works. So Satan seeks to attack the truths of God. He's done that, and he will continue to do that. And because Satan knows, if I can undermine the foundational principles, then the whole thing can topple. And that's his goal. It is to destroy the faith of God's people, to destroy the church. He is God's adversary, and he's our adversary, and seeks our downfall. So it's Paul is addressing this particular issue in Thessalonica, but he gives us more information here, and it's interesting what he talks about. And so we pick that up in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3. So he continues talking about this subject in light of something that is to come. And he says here in chapter 2, verse 3, Let no one deceive you by any means, whether by letter, by prophecy, or any other means, for that day will not come. So the day is going to come, but it will not come unless the falling away comes first and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition. So he's saying there are certain things that are to take place before Christ comes and we rise to meet him in the air and we get to spend eternity with him. So he's telling the people in Corinth or in Thessalonica, don't let anyone deceive you in any way. Don't be duped. People are going to try to dupe you. So we're closer to the end of the age than they were in Thessalonica. So he's saying that this is something that is a threat, and it continues to be a threat. So we have to keep that in mind, and we have to realize even if this somebody is sowing false teachings, even if it seems credible, we've got to really examine it and decide whether it's something we should hold to. The apostles made an appeal for the brethren to hold on to what they had already been taught, and that's what we've got to do. Most of us are not new in the church. We've been around a while. I'm not telling you anything we don't know. So the thing is, we need to stick to what we know that and believe and have believed because it's still relevant. It hasn't worked out yet, but we know it will. So we have to keep that in mind. Paul and his team, in this particular case is Paul, Silas, and Timothy, had taught the church that certain events were going to precede the day of the Lord. So certain events are coming, and these events had not yet occurred, which indicated that they were not on the verge of Christ's return, even though people were telling them, well, you are. Or it's already passed. Variations on the theme. So Paul explains, for that day will not come unless the rebellion or falling away occurs and the man of lawlessness is revealed. So these two events are to take place. One is there will be a rebellion or a falling away from the truth, and the man of lawlessness will be revealed. So Paul puts emphasis on the order of future events and explains what's coming first. So as you think about prophecy and it's being worked out, have we seen the man of sin? Nope, we haven't seen him. Has there come a falling away? To a certain extent, we've experienced that in the past, in the last 30 years. But I think there's a bigger event coming and a falling away from the truths of God. So this is something that has worked out in type throughout history, but the ultimate fulfillment is going to come in the future. So as you think about where I talked about the falling away, well, that's basically a rebellion, a rejection of the Word of God. And Paul explains that some form of rebellion is a sign of the last times. And both Jesus and Paul indicate that the Christians could anticipate people would leave the faith, that people would say, I'm no longer going to follow this way of belief. So when you think about our condition today, we're a pretty small group. Those people who are in the Church of God are not a large group. We're not looking at a very large number of people, but people will come to the point where I don't believe this anymore, or they'll walk away. And this is something that Christ predicted when he said that when he told his disciples in Matthew 24, verse 11. He said, then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. And false prophets have come throughout the history of the Church of God, but they are to come at the end of the age, most assuredly. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. So lawlessness is something that I think, as you look at the world in which we live, lawlessness definitely does abound. Lawlessness does abound. And unfortunately, when lawlessness abounds, then people do grow cold. They become hardened. And that's a sad condition for man to be in. 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 1, Paul talks about the same thing. 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 1. And there it says, "Now the Spirit expressly says, in the latter times, some will depart from the faith." So some will depart from the faith, giving heed to deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons. Remember what Isaiah said. That's exactly what Isaiah was talking about. Speaking lies and hypocrisy, having their own conscience seared with a hot iron. So basically it's talking about them becoming desensitized. You know, when you cauterize a wound, it seals it up and it becomes less sensitive. And that's something very serious, but is something that Paul is describing here that's eventually to work out. And as you look at the Church of God, what was their expectation after Christ had died, had risen, and returned to the third heaven to be with God until it was time for him to return? As you think about the church, they felt that Christ was going to come right away. That was their expectation. Christ is going to return. Well, that's true. But Christ didn't tell them exactly when that was going to happen. But people expected it to happen right away. And when Christ did not return right away, people were very disappointed and a lot of people left. A lot of people left the Church of God. And then the church suffered persecution. That was one of the challenges that they faced. They came under persecution, and when you are persecuted, it's harder to hold fast because people are threatening you because of what you believe, and they begin to make life hard for you because of what you believe. Now, we have been blessed in this age, the age that I've been in the church, when that has not been a formidable problem. It's been an off and on problem, but not something that has been as harsh as it has been at some time. But I would say as we come to the end of the age, then the persecution is going to increase. And you also look at people as they're walking in the faith, trying to keep the truths of Christianity. One of the challenges is this world is very tempting. And if you lose track of what should be priority, you can become caught up in the various movements and waves that are important to people in this world. And then you can lose sight of what's of real value. And so people were highly tempted and went back to the way that they were living before. And in the first century, many people left the faith. And this is a promise of what is to come. We're going to go through some challenges, and there will be people that will leave the faith. There will be people that we think, well, those people are rock solid, when in fact they weren't as solid as we thought they were. So then he introduces the man of sin and begins to talk about the man of sin, which is one of the things that is to take place before the return of Jesus Christ. And he's called the man of sin or man of lawlessness, and he is to be revealed. And one of the things I had not thought about is, you know, when Christ returns, it's a revelation. It's a revelation that will take place. The whole world will see it. But the man of sin, in a sense, is going to have his own revelation. He will be revealed. Not in the spectacular way that Christ returns, but he is going to come on the scene in a way that is going to get the world's attention and is going to impact the world. Now, I cannot say exactly how that's going to unfold, but when somebody comes on the scene and basically is impressive and impacting a lot of people, you got to step back and say, okay, what's going on here? Is this something I could pay attention to? Now, if you know anything about the return of Jesus Christ, you have to say, well, I don't think he's coming in the clouds. But you might think about, will he seek to duplicate that? Impress us in that way. They can read the scriptures just like we do. Satan's well aware of them. But exactly how this will play out, I don't know. So anyway, the man of sin is coming, and it's also called the lawless one. So interestingly, the imperial power of Rome, as embodied by the emperor, who received divine titles, is a prototype of the figure here described as the man of sin. So if you look at the Roman emperor in the time of Paul, for instance, one of the first ones that came on the scene was Octavius, who assumed the title of he was Octavian, and then he adopted another name, and he was seen as a god. And various Roman empires basically called themselves God. They said they were the incarnation of God and presented themselves in this particular way. And as you think about that, that's really quite an amazing conclusion to come to, that you would say that I am the manifestation of God. That's a pretty bold approach to impressing people and seeking to get people to recognize how great you are. In the New Testament, the Greek term commonly has to do with this, and this destruction, he's called the son of destruction. So he's going to be destroyed with the coming of Christ. And this promise that he would be destroyed because he's going to negatively impact the world. And through the things that the people in Thessalonica had been through, they were reassured by this, that this fellow, whoever he's going to be, is not going to win. That ultimately we're going to win as God leads us and intervenes on our behalf. So Paul, in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 4, Paul gives a fuller exposition of the character of the man of lawlessness. It says, he will oppose and will exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped, so that he sets himself up in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God. That is a very prideful approach that this individual will have. And the man's title implies that he will set himself up in a position of an adversary. I am God. What did Satan set himself up as? He set himself up as God's adversary. He sought to replace God. And God said, no, we're not going to do this. And he was defeated. But you have to look at this individual, this man of sin that is coming. Who is influencing this man? Look at the way he's acting. You know he has to be under Satan's influence to come to this conclusion and promote himself in this particular way. So he's going to exalt himself over every object of worship. I'm above everything. I'm above all men. I'm above all angels. I am God. And we have had various individuals throughout history who have come across in this particular way. One of them we know is Antiochus Epiphanes. He was exalted in his own mind, and he was very upset that the Jews were not submitting to his will. And so he thought, well, we're going to wipe out the Jews. And he undertook the effort to do that by desecrating the temple with swine's blood and setting up an idol in the temple. But interestingly, the Maccabees, a family there in Judah led a rebellion, and they defeated them, only by, I'm sure, God's intervention and help. But in Daniel chapter 11, it speaks about this an individual who is going to come on the scene, and it was going to have this mindset that we're going to see manifested in the future in the man of sin. Let's look at Daniel chapter 11, verses 36 and 37. Daniel 11, verses 36 and 37. There it says, "Then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods," that is the God of the Bible, "and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished." So God's going to allow him to be successful up to a point, and then God's going to intervene and say, enough of this. And for what has been determined shall be done. So this is going to work out. God's allowing it to work out, but it's going to work out in the long run in the way that he wants. "He shall regard neither the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall exalt himself above them all." Just an amazing amount of pride and hubris is on display with this individual. And Antiochus Epiphanes was such a man. As you look at Antiochus Epiphanes, he impacted the Jews. He profaned the temple in Jerusalem in the time of the Maccabees, and it inspired a rebellion, as I said. They defeated them, actually. And if you were looking at the Jews taking on the powerful empire of Antiochus, you would not have predicted the Jews would win. But they had the most important power in the universe on their side. So Antiochus' exaltation also extended over everything that is worshipped, which designates any sanctuary, idol, or person that receives adoration. I'm superior to all of this. And as I mentioned earlier, in 27 AD, the Roman Emperor Octavian took on the name Augustus. And if you look at, I didn't realize this before, I began studying this to a degree. One of the things that took place with Augustus was he was promoted in the Roman Empire as the coming of God, Augustus. And they preached a type of the gospel. He was the manifestation of God. This was something that they went about, in a sense, preaching the gospel. Interesting that this is taking place at the time of the apostles and others going out and preaching the gospel. Why would Satan undertake that at that time? Again, he seeks to counter what God does and deceive people. So Augustus, this Roman emperor, was exalted as a god. And, it's pretty audacious what happens with this man of sin. And we see that this has taken place, and it's not something that just took place in New Testament times. If you go back to what Ezekiel had to say about the king of the prince of Tyre in Ezekiel chapter 28, verse 2. Ezekiel chapter 28, verse 2, it's talking about this guy that felt he was a very special and a manifestation of God. And it says in Ezekiel chapter 28, verse 2, it says, "In the pride of your heart you say, I am a god. I am a god. I sit on the throne of a god. I sit on the throne of a god in the heart of the seas, here in my beautiful city of Tyre. But you are a man and not a god, though you think you are as wise as a god. Will you then say, I am a god, in the presence of those who kill you?" when you're a god, and here come these people that eventually take you out and kill you, end your life, you're not quite as exalted as you think you are. So the man who of lawlessness who exalts himself as a god will meet his end at the coming of Christ. Now it talks about him setting himself up in a temple, and the most common interpretation of that particular part of the prophecy is that he will set himself up in the temple of God in Jerusalem. That's been the common interpretation. As we've already noted, when the man, you know, Antiochus Epiphanes came, he did put up a statue of Dionysius in the temple, and he did sacrifice swine's blood in the temple, but he did not take up residence in there. So to that extent, he really did not fulfill it completely. Partially, he fulfilled it. A better example of somebody exalting themselves to the stature of a god would be Caligula. You've probably heard of Caligula. And he tried to have his own image placed in the temple in Jerusalem in 40 AD. So he had the statue made, he had the statue sent out, and expected it to be placed in the temple in Jerusalem in 40 AD. But for some reason, the person that was tasked to carry that out, the Roman legate who was in Damascus, he did not carry out what he was asked to do. For some reason, he did not carry it out, and the people of Rome got tired of Caligula and killed him in 41, so that never took place. But it was a type of what is to come. And he fulfilled it more than Augustus did or Antiochus Epiphanes did. These events, which Paul would have known well, may have served as the prototype for the way the man of lawlessness will seek recognition as divine. So you can look back and you can see some historical precedents which may give us some clue of how things are going to work out. It is common to identify the temple with the temple in Jerusalem, but we might step back. This particular prophecy was passed along by Paul to the people in Thessalonica. Now, if you think about where Thessalonica is, it's in Greece, in the Macedonian part of Greece. And would this have impacted them? What do they know about the temple in Jerusalem? The general population wouldn't have known anything about it. Now, maybe those who were Jews, they would have definitely known about it, but Christians, that people that became Christians really might not have known so much about it. So, as I said, it's common to identify the temple with the temple in Jerusalem, but would they have understood that reference? The events in Jerusalem previously described occurred far from Thessalonica. It's just something to contemplate here that is a little different. The temple in Jerusalem is the domain of the God of Israel, and we have no explanation concerning how the man of lawlessness could establish his place of worship there in the temple in Jerusalem. And if you think about it in the 21st century, this is yet to come. Where is the temple of God? There is no physical temple at this point. That brings up the question, will they rebuild it? We've talked about that, and that may take place in some shape or form. So we know that where is the temple of God in the 21st century? Where is it today? We are the temple of God. We, the church, are the temple of God. Now, is the man of sin going to come into the church? I doubt that, but we'll see how it all works out. So, but we do know that this man is to come. He's going to impact the world in a very powerful way. And so we might think about that it may not work out exactly as we think it might. This is just something to think about because of looking at things historically. So it goes on and it says that additionally, as we think about this, we have to think about 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Let's look at verse 5 and to the next few verses. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 5. There Paul says, "Do you remember that when I was still with you, I told you these things?" So look, we've gone over this. I've told you these things. "And now you know what is restraining, that he may be revealed in his own time." So that verse is pretty controversial and difficult to understand. What's restraining? I mean, the way that I would look at it is something's holding this back. We don't know exactly what's holding it back, but something is holding it back and eventually will be moved out of the way. It says, so there's something restraining that he may be revealed in his own time. So we know that God works things out in a particular way. He works out things according to his timing. And when it's time, this man will be revealed. And it will fit exactly with what has been prophesied. It says in verse 7, "For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work." The mystery of lawlessness is already at work. "Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way." So whatever is restraining will be moved out of the way, and at that time, the man of sin will manifest himself. Now, what is restraining? I don't know. Paul explained it to the Thessalonians. They knew, but he didn't reveal it to us. So that's probably good for us in the long run, but we don't know what that means exactly. So once that restraint is removed, then he will manifest himself. It's and as I mentioned, we'll just explain some of these things here. It says the secret mystery power of lawlessness is already at work. So in some way, the man of sin is being manifested. There's a certain spirit and attitude and certain things that go along with it, and that mystery is already at work. It was already working in the time of the Thessalonians, and it has continued to work, and it's at work right now. So something that ties in with that verse is working out right now. And the power of lawlessness is already at work. And so that's eventually, but we can see it, and there are certain mystery religions and that are still working and still commonly practiced, and we're not going to get into that today. The explanation of the events that will come before the day of the Lord was not new information for the readers of this letter, but it's something that's challenging for us because we don't know the answers to some of the things Paul relayed to them. So in the midst of the response concerning the false teaching about the day of the Lord, he's talking about these things and asking them to remember what he's told them. Finally, the Thessalonians had already received instruction about the apostasy and the coming of the man of lawlessness. So they're reminded that this is coming. And one verse that I thought was well translated in the Amplified Bible speaks about this. And it says, "And you know what restrains him now from being revealed. It is so that he will be revealed at his own time, his appointed time." So there's something holding this man of lawlessness back from being revealed, and we don't know every detail of that. So as you go on here, although the Thessalonian believers could already witness the presence of this demonic force that anticipated the man of lawlessness, his revelations would be detained until the proper time. So something's going on. It's probably religious, and it is, you can see that, but you can't see this man that is to manifest himself. So something is to work out, and it's something that we can be aware of. And if we see something that fits with what Paul has laid out here, then we know that we're right close to the end of the age. Final verse today in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 8, it says, "Then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming." So yes, something is coming. Yes, it will manifest itself. It won't be good for the people of God. It will be part of the chaos and confusion and upheaval at the end of the age, but Christ is coming. We're assured of that. We're assured that the difficult time at the end of the age that is described here in 2 Thessalonians will come to an end. It will manifest itself. It will be revealed, but it will come to an end as Christ returns. With the coming of Christ and the saints, then the best world we've ever been a part of can manifest itself. And the challenge for all of us is to keep the faith, to continue in the faith and don't let anything derail us, and then we can enjoy the kingdom that is promised to come.